Hey, man, what's up? We're talking about Epstein. Yes. You're looking like very much like a beatnik, like a guy who'd be in like the Vincenieros brigade in like 1962 or something like that. Very appropriate.
Yeah, I did it for this recording specifically. I had a whole different outfit on, and then 5 minutes ago I said, shit, I'm supposed to be on this Cuba thing.
Well, thank you for doing that for this audio-only recording. It's very kind of you.
I did enjoy the picture of you two talking in Cuba because maybe it's just projecting, because I spoke in Cuba in 2019.
But did you wear a pink linen suit?
Yes, I wore something very similar. You both look a little bit hot and frazzled. Was I wrong about that?
Not at all.
No, no, you're not wrong.
Well, I mean, the thing was that we were there, and it was apparently like some of the coldest weather they've had in a decade plus.
Okay.
Which is to say it was in the 60s and 70s. Yeah. And which meant that we were wearing I was wearing short sleeves, and we were talking to people who were wearing like three layers. But we had by the time we did that talk, I think Brent and I had been on the road for like about a week, and so we were you know, ready to
frazzled.
Yeah, just a little bit.
You're ready to come back to the socialist paradise of New York City, having left Cuba with our socialist mayor, Zoran, who apparently refuses to raise the outdoor temperatures above freezing, leading to a vast social crisis throughout this entire city,
I went to the big anti-ICE protest on Friday, which was massive, although, you know, not very interesting. The PSL steered everyone away from two very good targets, which was the Hilton Hotel, where ICE is apparently staying, and the ICE building in the West Village. We walked right past them to the park. I'm not saying we should have attacked them, or we just could have just like stopped there for a second so people knew where they were. But I thought it would be really funny if people passing by didn't know, like, weren't reading the news about ICE or anything. And it did just appear to be a protest against the snow and the
concept
ICE.
Of ICE.
Because they have signs of like a cube of ice, and it's like, melt the ice, you know?
Water has been solidifying for far too long. Yeah. We have to put a stop to it. That is like the tenor of, I'm not sure if you guys are on social media, but there are all sorts of complaints from the worst types of New Yorkers. Some guy called like strip mall realtor in New York. He's like, I can't believe that the mayor has done such a piss poor job of like keeping the streets clear. It's like, bro, it's fucking like 18 degrees every day here. This is like the best you're going to get.
There was a guy from the American Enterprise Institute who posted like, yes, the warmth of collectivism has yet to melt the snow or get the trash picked up. And it's like, I don't know if you know, I don't know what they're doing over at the American Enterprise Institute, but I believe it is not teaching the freezing point.
Is there some policy about after snowstorms, like trash collection doesn't, I don't know, that they like, they pause for a second or something?
Yeah, it's suspended, I believe. I know because I have friends in the DSNY, New York's Strongest. Shout out to Teamsters.
Real heroes.
The real heroes, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Local 831, Uniform Sanitation Men's Association. Respect. You guys are killing it out there. I know for a fact, because I speak with them, that they're working as many hours as possible right now to clear your fucking streets. And I hate to say it, folks, like, I don't know, like, in what world you live in, but there are physics and there's like science, and you know, there's only so many hours that fucking sanitation guys can work in a particular day. They're making as much overtime as they possibly can. All right, everybody relax. They're making double time and time and a half out there, 13 hours a day to fucking do it.
And like, I am able to see what's happening in other cities and hear about what's happening in other cities, and in Philly and in DC, it sounds way worse. I mean, the specific thing I have an issue with in New York, and it's not something Zoran can fix because it's a problem with us, which is that, like, the snow is just, it's like a big fucking toilet. Like, you walk around outside, and it looks like it, you know, like, there's lots of, like, piss, cigarette butts, et cetera. And
it absorbs all the sins of the city.
Exactly. But in Philly, like, I have a friend, John Semley. And like they like their street didn't get plowed, so like the neighbors, like, they pooled money together to hire somebody to like unfuck their street.
Unfuck the street.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're not here to talk. Guys, we're here with the blowback boys. We're not here to talk about the weather. We're not here to talk about the freezing point of water, even. if you could believe it. We're not even here to talk about ice. We're here to talk about linen suits. We're here to talk about sugar production. We're here to talk about revolutions that may or may not have happened 65 years ago and their consequences. Welcome to the shows, guys.
Well, I do have one thing to say about weather.
Please.
We're recording this on Groundhog's Day, and Punxsutawney Phil sadly did predict 6 more weeks of winter. He's optimistic. You know, that's like the bad thing, but hearing you go to Cuba around the same time that Trump has called for this new round of blockades to do regime change in Cuba reminds me, going back to a very similar thing I experienced when I went to Cuba in 2019. I left on April 30th, which was the day of that Guaido coup in Caracas. And so my first flight, I was hearing about that on the news. And then for the connecting flight in Fort Lauderdale, I caught up on the news and Trump was saying that there was going to be this full blockade of Cuba, calling Cuba a terrorist state. And so I get on my flight to Havana wondering if I'm ever going to come back.
Wow.
Fortunately, I guess he didn't do it. He didn't do that stuff then because the coup was such a failure. And, you know, Maduro won. And so they kind of kept the same status quo. Maybe they heightened Helms-Burton a little bit enforcement after that, but now it seems like they're getting more serious.
Is that the impression that you guys got having been to Cuba?
That's the impression. We were there just the past week when the not policy, but gesture, just sort of brute force was applied to, I suppose you could say persuade Mexico, hitherto supportive of Cuba in the region, to stop providing Cuba with fuel. And then a couple of days after that, we were still there when the White House released some new fact sheet that explained why it was imposing tariffs on anyone who supplied Cuba with fuel. So you have the recent successful, whatever you want to call it, in Venezuela, the kidnapping, not quite regime change, but regime modification.
Gunboat diplomacy 2.0, yeah.
Yeah, and then you have this with Mexico. Those are two, if we're treating Cuba as a bipedal being here, those are the two legs cut off. Fuel wise completely. And Mexico has announced, I think Sheinbaum said she will be sending humanitarian aid in lieu of the fuel. But one would hope if you're in Cuba that she's coming up with a way to, I don't know, buy time to reverse this or work something out with Trump to pretty soon get fuel back into Cuba, because this really would be a crisis that could bring on something disastrous in Cuba if they're left without any fuel from these places whatsoever, these imports.
Yeah, the oil imports in the last few years, I think a lot of people assume, not incorrectly, that Venezuela is a key supplier of oil. But in the last few years, actually, the more important supplier to Cuba of oil has been Mexico. And Cuba is able... It has some of its own oil supplies, except the oil that Cuba has is very sulfurous and it's very thick. And Cuba's electrical grid is already very technologically, decayed and
outdated.
Is exactly. And they deal with blackouts all the time. Not just they have planned blackouts, which we experienced when we were there. Roughly half the time we were there, I would say we were in a blackout. But they also have unplanned blackouts, that occur not infrequently. And this is how their grid runs. It's very easy to say, like, oh, why don't they convert to solar? And it's like, well, that costs money. And Cuba's a poor country. And the Soviet Union doesn't exist. And so there isn't, like, a major benefactor that is able to step up in that kind of way. And thus handicapping them by removing the Mexican oil that they're able to buy, the estimate. This is reported in the Financial Times, but it's been said elsewhere, and the Cubans aren't denying it, is that they have a bit under 3 weeks left of oil at hand to be able to keep their grid going. And people in Cuba and authorities there are preparing to figure out how to make life work as best they can without electricity.
Wow.
It is a all hands on deck crisis.
Yeah, I saw some video of taxi drivers queuing up for days, hoping to get some gasoline because they're severely rationing it. And this is on top of a pretty dire situation that's gotten worse since the pandemic, like month by month. And I had already heard reports before this all began that this is as bad as it's been since the special period, if not in some ways worse. But yes. What was your impression from being there?
I was there a couple years ago in 2022. I went as part of a delegation, just this organization called, I believe it's called Witness for Peace Solidarity Collective was the group that helped me go the first time. And I will say, you know, I spent some time in Havana. I spent some time in Matanzas. So I got around the country a bit. I won't say I was, you know, I covered every inch of Cuba, but I do not remember seeing homeless people or people begging. I don't recall a blackout. Maybe I was just out and about while one happened or asleep or something, but I don't recall that. This time, there were certainly people begging. I think some of them were probably homeless. There were, as Noah mentioned, blackouts every day, both scheduled and unscheduled. And things were far, far worse. And things were not great when I went in 2022. Trump had put on the turbo sanctions over the existing blockade, something that Biden, in one of his administration's greater sins of omission, refused to pull back on. And people were already comparing it to the special period back then. But now, with all of that plus the withholding of oil and fuel from friendly countries, it's we're very close to just having nowhere else for them to go for any kind of stable existence day by day. So that's what I saw and felt very obviously compared to my first trip in 2022.
Yeah, maybe I can play a little bit of this Marco Rubio clip of him and Congress.
I'm a Marco Rubio completionist. I like to watch all of his clips, so please do.
Is your comments that Havana should be concerned about the Maduro operation is fueling speculation that this administration will turn its sights to Cuba next? Will you make a public commitment today to rule out U.S. regime change in Cuba?
Regime change?
Yes.
Oh, no, I think we would love to see the regime there change. We would like to. That doesn't mean that we're going to make a change, but we would love to see it change. There's no doubt about the fact that it would be of great benefit to the United States if Cuba was no longer governed by an autocratic regime.
I mean, but you know what we mean by regime change. We don't mean I wish someone else were in charge. When we talk about regime change, we're talking about using the power of the United States, usually kinetic power, but often other kinds of coercion And I'm not even saying that that's always not in our interest. I'm just saying, I'm not asking you whether we would prefer.
I'm not saying I'm against this
kind of government. I'm
not that there's anything wrong with
whether you are trying to precipitate the fall of the current regime.
Yeah, but that's statutory. The Helms-Burton Act, the U.S. embargo on Cuba is codified. It was codified in law, and it requires regime change in order for us to lift the embargo.
All right, now can I be the first person to respond to this? Do you guys mind?
Please.
Oh, no, I don't have anything profound to say, but I just found it very interesting watching this clip in preparation. And I do celebrate his entire catalog, Marco Rubio. But this particular clip was fascinating to me because he falls back on Congress having passed the Helms-Burton Act. It's statutory. It's codified, right? This is a regime, the Trump regime, that's like a bull in a china shop. And in fact, it's like part of its vice signaling to its own base is that it doesn't follow the rules, is that statutory and codified means nothing to it. In fact, it's the bull in the china shop that goes in and like breaks everything up. And it's fascinating to see Marco Rubio, who's not just a member of this administration, but I think wears like five or six different hats, coming and saying, well, it's statuary and it's codified, as though this is an administration that cares. So it's interesting to see where the Trump administration follows the law and where it doesn't. And in this case, of course, with Cuba regime change, we follow the Congress.
Well, statutory definitely has a different ring to it in the Trump administration.
Hi-oh.
I do. I would say that the the thing though that is like that he's doing, like the essence of what he is describing, is something though that like it is worth sitting with, which is that like, you know, why was it that the Obama maneuver was so tepid in the grand scheme of things? Like in 2016, Obama initiates a thaw and it's not, you know, it doesn't go all the way, et cetera. And, you know, we've now got a situation where we have worse than reversed. We're in a much worse position. And I think the Cubans would feel they're in a much worse position vis-a-vis the United States than they necessarily were right before that because of how hostile it is. And what Rubio is reminding Senator Brian Schatz of there is that actually, you know, this is like longstanding held interest. This is we're doing the normal thing,
right?
Like this is normal. And I can't say that I disagree. I mean, like, obviously the extreme nature of it is, you know, further than any administration has gone in decades, realistically since the Kennedy era, frankly. But I think that there is it's worth identifying that, you know, like Rubio, like awful guy that he is and awful intent that he has. I don't think he was wrong there and wrong to raise the fact that there is like a fundamental normalcy to U.S. hostility to Cuba.
I will say, though, to your point about the somewhat contradictory stance of the Trump administration, you know, both seeming to ignore the institutions that are usually supposed to keep the executive in check, but then citing them when it's convenient or whatever. The fact sheet or whatever, you know, that they released justifying the new actions against Cuba, it's the perfect distillation of the contradictory sort of two-headed freak baby that the current Trump White House is, with Rubio driving this sort of neocon foreign policy in the name of MAGA and American interests and America first, because you have at the very top of the document, as we always have to have now, this is something that is protecting U.S. national security,
right,
and putting the Americans first. And then for the rest of the document, where Rubio's actual language and spirit is evident, you see we're trying to put profits back in the hands of the Cuban people. We're standing with the Cuban people. We're trying to get meaningful reforms for the Cuban people. Why the fuck should we care about the Cuban people in the MAGA administration?
Right, in the America First administration, yeah.
It's getting your chocolate in my peanut butter with the neocon, you know, faux idealism in what is, you know, according to everybody, supposed to be a brutally nationalistic and one-minded America First government, which all I'm really saying there is, it's sort of, as Noah was also saying, business as usual, which is whatever the justification, we're going to be doing whatever we want, wherever we want.
And there's also one other piece of this that I think to, you know, which is getting peanut butter in my chocolate, which is that there is like, okay, the more and more you strangle Cuba, the more and more that you exacerbate out migration from Cuba to the United States, which has already been taking place at a pretty unprecedented pace over the last few years. Because now, you know, historically, Cubans have a kind of exceptional relationship with the U.S. immigration system, colloquially known as wet foot, dry foot, meaning that if you're a Cuban who makes it to the U.S. and applies for asylum, like there's a pathway to citizenship for you here. There's a pathway to permanent residency. And right now, like the Trump administration is tearing up all that shit. You know, the founder of Latinos for Trump, who is a Cuban emigre who had like a Trump tattoo on him, he's been deported and he's being sent back to Cuba. And the like,
how's that tattoo going to play in Havana? I wonder.
That's a good question.
He's going to have to Graham Platner that.
There is this like other, you know, another contradiction is that they are pursuing a policy regime against Cuba that will exacerbate the other thing that supposedly these people, you know, in their America First mindset want to stop, which is like having people come to our border.
I will say, though, Noah, we talked about this. And by the way, the clip that you guys were playing just of Rubio there was at least sourced there on YouTube by Belly of the Beast, some wonderful journalists that we met with while we were there and whom we've known long distance for a bit. And they were very gracious hosts to us. And people should check out their stuff, Belly of the Beast. It's very good English language coverage of Cuba much of the time. But we talked about it with them as well. I don't know, Noah. Like we were saying, to me, if they exacerbate migration from Cuba into the United States, yes, that's quote unquote contradictory, but I think they'll just like the worse, the better. Then they'll just crack more heads. Yeah. They don't really care how many immigrants are in the United States at any given time. They care about how much they can show them deporting people at any given time. The absolute number, I think, is irrelevant. And even if this policy, if they break Cuba and then a lot of people show up in Miami or whatever, they'll just celebrate ritualistically with more and more campaigns against the new arrivals, don't you think?
Send ICE to Miami. It's a lot easier to melt them there.
Well,
right?
Brendan is not wrong at all. And in fact, one of the things we heard from Cubans we know is that actually what's common is that the people who are calling ICE on these new Cuban arrivals are old Cubans, old Cuban arrivals in the U.S., people who came in earlier waves of immigration, like the, you know, Marielitos, or people who came in the 60s and 50s, like Marco Rubio's family. I mean, it's a kind of cynicism that personifies, you know, or just describes this whole process. But no, I agree with everything Brennan said. Like it's contradictory insofar as it's like a contradiction in stated values, but it's not actually like a contradiction in policy or in practicalities because a bunch of, you know, like more footage of like guys on horseback, like cracking whips at people crossing the Rio Grande. Like it's not like that. That is also what conservatives
want. That was Biden, wasn't it?
That was the whips. The whips admittedly were Biden, but I assume that they've not stopped.
As Kamala Harris once said, do not come. Do not come.
Can I just read for a second while I still have it up? The white paper here about why we're doing this.
Yeah, please.
It's very interesting because they bring new things in that are patently absurd as to what Cuba is up to that makes it a threat, but also forget things that were, you know, pretty scary sounding a year ago that they were using, like the Chinese bases and stuff. They don't talk about the Chinese cooperation whatsoever. The bullet points here on the Rubio paper are: the Cuban regime aligns itself with numerous hostile countries and malign actors hosting their military and intelligence capabilities. For example, Cuba hosts Russia's largest overseas signals intelligence facility focused on stealing sensitive national security information. Okay, which is just like that sounds like it should be something, but it really isn't. Cuba provides safe haven for transnational terrorist groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas.
And that's right, folks. Cuba is Hamas.
Way to square the circle there. Go on.
Which, I mean, obviously, while we were there, people were laughing, you know, at the sheer ridiculousness of that claim. Three, the regime persecutes and tortures political opponents, blah, blah, blah. Profits from the Cuban people's misery and incites chaos by spreading communist ideology across the region. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't like it. It's kind of this mixture of boilerplate, then some 20th century stuff, and then Hamas, but not mentioning China stuff. It's a weird document, actually, all things considered.
Thank you for reading from that, because I think that as we sit here, you know, maybe we can be accused of trying to sane-wash Trump. I don't think any of us are doing that. I think we do want to kind of try to tease out what these contradictions are that we're pointing to and how there might be some rationality, maybe not at the top, but bubbling up from the bottom. And I think the best you could say for Trump's foreign policy, such as it's been, is a recognition that there will be regional hegemonies, that the United States can no longer be the world hegemon, pulling away from Europe, allegedly maybe going to Asia, but importantly, creating the idea is to create a kind of fortress Western hemisphere, right? Mm-hmm. Greenland is part of that. Cuba is part of this. Grafted on top of that is the allegation by, I believe, Alistair Crook, who's a former diplomat in Britain, said that Miriam Adelson, when she gave Trump the $100 million that really gave some power to his campaign recently, wanted John Bolton to be his Secretary of State. And Trump said no. She said, okay, well, how about Marco Rubio, right? And he said, okay, that's fine. Hey, little Marco, he's fine. But
some interesting stuff about Bolton and the Epstein files, by the way, how he ended up in the first Trump administration.
Little Marco didn't make it. That's a different story. But to finish my point, I guess what I'm saying is the contradictions aren't just like us four schlubs pointing them out. The contradictions within America First and Trump's foreign policy are being worked out in the real world as we speak. And it's a difference between personnel within the administration, sure, but it's also the chaotic nature of Trump and Trumpism and MAGA and America First as when it runs up against American empire that is leading to these contradictions that we see. And so we're watching them play out in real time and we can analyze them and see them, but it's still very inchoate right now, I guess is what I'm saying. It's still very much.
I agree
with that. I would also add that one of the other things, something that comes up in blowback a lot, is that American foreign policy interests are, you know, they're driven sometimes by just, you know, outright smash and grab stuff. Like, we want your frickin' oil. We want your bauxite. We want your some kinds of natural resources, whatever. Fine. And then a lot of the time it is driven by like domestic politics. It has not felt, I think, since the Iraq war, the calculus of this has changed a bit. But historically, the easiest way for an American president to fix flagging approval ratings was to start a war. You know, George H.W. Bush certainly pioneered, certainly was, a good example of this, whether it's in Panama or the Gulf War, as a recession bore down on him. And I think in the case of Cuba, if we look at the contemporary moment, we see a lot of L's for the Trump administration. I mean, granted, they're kicking up a plenty of shit and there's a lot of stuff that I would certainly say are victories for the forces of evil. But from their perspective and from the perspective of polling, they are not succeeding in conveying to people that, hey, listen, we're winning right now. And so, you know, Venezuela kidnapping Maduro and the theater of that and signaling to Latin America, oh, no, we're doing the Don Roe Doctrine now. We're focusing on, to borrow your phrase, which I believe also Nikhil Paul Singh, the professor at NYU, has also emphasized this idea of like a homeland empire. I think that Cuba fits into that matrix, certainly, as, you know, it's in the Western Hemisphere and it's an enemy and so forth. But also, you know, these people are looking for a dub, and they see this tiny island, you know, like 90 miles off the coast of Florida, and they see an opportunity to squeeze it when it's already very weak and to try and wring something like a victory out of it. And it's a really, I mean, it's an unbelievably depressing thought, but it is the idea that they're doing this precisely because they think it will be something that a bunch of Americans would look at and say, oh, that that horrible like wave of immiseration that we're like throwing at them. Yeah, that's awesome. And that actually makes me like the Trump administration more, even if my groceries are going up and everything else about the world and everything else sucks or whatever.
Honestly, I would say that is not so different from, honestly, I think that is not so different from the rationale of the Biden people, because as I mentioned earlier, Trump term one, he slapped on over 200 new sanctions that, turbocharged the existing embargo or blockade or whatever you want to call it. Biden got rid of none of those and certainly didn't return to any kind of easy, which was only 4 years earlier, pre-Trump, any kind of opening up with Cuba that he could have, you know, painted with the colors of hope and change and Obama is coming back and the Obama era and all of that. He could have probably very easily done that, and he chose not to. People we spoke to, and I find it persuasive, feel as though it's because he had enough people, maybe people like Marco Rubio, in his ear going, just wait it out. Because if you let those sanctions do their work and you see how bad things are right now, you could preside by doing nothing. You could preside over the fall of communist Cuba, and that'll be on your CV. And while the Trump people are being more aggressive about it, I think that they view it the same way as the Biden people did, an easy win that can be achieved by simply putting a little bit more pressure on the boot, on the neck.
Yeah, I mean, that's nearly what's working in Iran right now. You know, like the uprising there basically has to do with their currency no longer having any value. And so I think that obviously for decades, U.S. foreign policy has been to try to do regime change through like immiserating the social life so bad that people have to have an uprising. There was a little bit of an uprising in Cuba in 2021 that was short-lived and hasn't flared up again since. But, you know, if you get to the point where there's no more electricity, it's certainly possible.
And to maybe point out something that's different nowadays, from a break from that continuity of like American policy blockade towards Cuba, sanctions or whatever, which is related to this wag the dog thing, which is that, you know, this has been a domestic football in the United States. God, of course, going back to Kennedy, right? Going back to Eisenhower. But the United States domestically, we've seen is ungovernable right now, like legitimately ungovernable. I'm not just talking about Minneapolis. I'm talking about the Congress. You know, I'm talking about statutory and codifying things. Like our Congress doesn't govern anymore. The courts are all blocked up. The executive branch is getting so much power these days under Trump because there's such an ungovernability on the domestic level. So I think that's leading to a radicalization and a desperation on the part of foreign policy people who have been around for a long time banging the drums of war. Wagging the dog isn't like an option anymore. I feel like it's becoming a necessity, right? So Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, China, Greenland, right? These things are reaching this fever pitch, I think, because things are so bad domestically.
Yeah.
And we spoke about this in Cuba when we had the opportunity. And I was thinking about it while we were there with regard to Cuba, but also Iran and all the places you mentioned, Greenland and Venezuela, is whether you sort of read it through the person of Trump or the sort of Trumpism and the apparatus around him, there is somewhat like, I think, the case of any great power that's in decline. You could say this is happening in Russia. You could certainly say it's happening with us. Trump is there to manage the decline of a once powerful empire that they pretty much know all the graphs are pointing downwards. And so, as you mentioned earlier, what was once a global ambition to sort of govern things globally becomes more of a hemispheric ambition where we can have our backyard and run that the way we want, if not everything in Asia and everything in the Middle East, et cetera. And grabbing Greenland is an easy way to just tack another easy win on. Cuba falls, another easy win. Getting free oil from Venezuela, another easy win. It's all in service of this legacy that can be established during the Trump terms one and two, but especially two, to say, hey, look, I grabbed us a bunch of easy wins. I grabbed us some land. I grabbed us some free oil, and I grabbed us a symbolic Cold War victory, Cold War era victory that no one else was able to do. It's not so different from the Kennedy Center renaming. You know, it's just like I'm putting that they won't be able to say I didn't intervene and, you know, expand the StarCraft map a little bit, you know, when the rush started to happen. And I think that that's, as you say, part of the desperation and part of the improvisation that's going on to, in the case of certainly the Venezuela coup, in somewhat novel ways, achieve these foreign policy victories or perceived victories is in service of a legacy that says we reversed the decline. We at least made it stay still.
Let me ask another question along those lines. As I read just today that a Russian cargo plane has landed near Havana, presumably dropping off some military equipment as they did before the operation in Venezuela. And you know, even after that operation, there was these kind of weird naval piracy exhibitions of the U.S. stealing Russian shadow fleet oil cargo ships. I don't totally understand what was going on with that. But, you know, Russia and Cuba have maintained an alliance, as that white paper mentioned. Is there an aspect of this that you think plays into Trump's desire to get some kind of ceasefire in Ukraine?
I hear they dropped off another Havana Syndrome machine, or it might have been the Brown Tone machine. I don't know which it was, but watch yourselves in the U.S. Embassy. That's all I got to say.
It's unclear, and I don't think it's been like it has not been publicly. Like, there hasn't been a lot of public commentary or examination of a relationship between whatever Russia's doing in Eastern Europe and whatever Russia's allies or friends are doing in the Caribbean. I mean, it's not implausible to me that that's how people in Washington think, because nothing sounds that implausible to me anymore on that level. But I do think that there is, like, looking at it from the reverse, I think that the Cuba issue is something that the White House is very happy to try and use to discipline or challenge foreign governments that it otherwise does not have that much to challenge them on, because of just, like, you know, like basic geopolitics or basic math. For example, the Mexico thing. So this executive order, which contains the facts of that white paper, quote unquote facts of that white paper, it is, you know, it says that we're going to tariff the shit out of anybody who does oil business with Cuba. And that's, you know, that really is about one country. It's about Mexico right now. And in the same way, I think that there is also the other countries that are considered the prime benefactors of Cuba, you know, or potential supports for huge potential bases of support for big aid. For example, China and Russia as well. You know, Trump is essentially daring them, like, go help these little guys. Yeah, I had to back off the tariffs, the real tariffs that I was going to do on either Mexico or China, because it turns out that our economies are really, you know, interwoven, and actually doing that big boy tariff stuff would really fuck stuff up and fuck up the money. But I think that the Cuba issue is, again, this is, you know, to your point about, like, we were saying, Sean, about how we have to do these things abroad because America is ungovernable. I think that this is kind of similar, where this is something that the Trump people have kind of, you know, because they get hip to new ideas very, very quickly. It does seem that in the tones of how they're talking about this, they're like, oh, we found a new cudgel. We found a new thing that we can use to, like, wield and look strong with, but that actually is not, you know, and will only, if things go, you know, if things don't go the way we want them, will only result in the complete immiseration of the 9 million or so people that live on that island, and will not actually jeopardize American Mexican or American Chinese relations.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think bracketing off what both you and Brandon said, like, this idea of easy wins, this idea of deals. Like, if you're a real estate guy, it's all about leverage, right? You're trying to make deals. And so people suspect that the reason that we haven't attacked Iran yet, and maybe we will in the next couple of months, maybe we will tomorrow, for all you know, when this comes out, we will have already attacked Iran, is that we find it very difficult to find any leverage over them. Just like the Russians, we don't have a lot of leverage over them. Who do we have leverage over? One of those small countries that periodically, as an empire, we need to throw up against the wall, just as a demonstration effect. This is leverage over actors throughout the region and throughout the world. I would like to point out that Cuba, in its public-facing diplomacy and what it says about itself, we'll talk about this Nuestra America document that came out of a conference in Cuba recently. Out of Colombia, thank you. Colombia, Cuba, Russia, China, fucking large swaths of Europe right now are holding on to, trying to hold on to the UN charter, trying to hold on to international law, attempting to, like, make real this idea of a rules-based American international order long after, or at least 1 year after, America has given up on the entire thing. So we have a very strange bifurcated world right now, one where there is a state of international law that Cuba can fall back on, that Russia and China can claim to be in support of. And then there is this rogue madman United States, which goes around, it seems, and throws countries up against the wall in order to gain leverage for other countries for making deals. And where this connects with what Brandon said is, he kept saying easy wins. If those are the only wins that you can get, those are the only wins that you go for, right? So Cuba, I agree, would be an easy win in a situation where all we have left anymore is, like, easy wins, right?
I'll raise something Brendan pointed out to me a few days ago, which is that, you know, in a lot of ways, the Trump, this part, I'm paraphrasing something he said a bit, but, like,
Right. Make sure you get it fucking right.
Get it right or pay the price.
Well, I'm on notice, I guess. the thing that is kind of interesting, you use the word madman, and that's a really interesting phrase to bring up, because when Nixon was telling Kissinger what he wanted, or not, sorry, Kissinger, he was telling Bob Haldeman, I believe, might have been Ehrlichman, but he was telling one of his advisors.
One of the guys he did his best racisms with.
Yes, exactly. He was telling one of his, like, shoot the shit racism buddies, who also happened to be some of the most powerful people in the country at that time. He was telling them what he wanted to, like, what was the tack he wanted to take in negotiations with the Vietnamese. And he says, I want them to think I'm crazy. I want to be a madman. And it was about, and, you know, this was madman theory, he called it. And the idea was that you want them to think that you are capable of doing anything. And so this will come to the table. And I think that that dovetails with another thing, or another belief, another theory of the world that was espoused by another Nixon advisor, Henry Kissinger, which was Kissinger's career in academia and right prior to kind of getting into politics. One of the things that he espoused was this idea of fighting little wars. The idea was that in the age of superpowers, you can't actually do direct confrontations because of nukes, because you just don't have the political will for it. You have to do little wars. You have to find these little wars that you can exploit. And, you know, ideally you get enough of them going that you trip up your opponent and they fall down. And I think that that is a little bit, you know, we see the Trump people by a virtue of a different set of motivations, far less brain power, but, you know, in different circumstances, they've arrived at a similar kind of formulation. They can't actually ask Americans, you know, to put down the treats and to go and fight a fucking war against Iran, or to, like, you know, put boots on the ground in Cuba, but they can and will get America, you know, in their head. I'm not sure this will actually work out the way they intend it to domestically. They believe that they can get Americans to rally around the flag as we brutalize these little countries in service of some strategic, you know, aim. And I think that it's, you know, we are seeing a kind of, again, it's not totally a return to form, but we are seeing similar things from the past being deployed in the present in terms of, you know, targeting little countries, targeting countries that on their own can't possibly defeat the United States, as a strategy of how the U.S. gets to show its power and assert its presence in the world.
Maybe this would be a good time to transition to talk a little bit about Cuban domestic politics, or, you know, what it means that Cuba is a communist country, and also maybe the your experience in Colombia as part of this Progressive International
Before
Conference.
Before we do that, can I say one thing?
Well, go for it.
All right. The last thing I'll say on this. It struck me when the news came out that we bombed various different nuclear facilities in Iran, and it kind of bubbled to the surface, and people who paid attention like myself could figure out that actually what Trump did was make a deal with the mullahs, quote unquote, right? The clerics in Iran, and said, we're going to get in and out. We're going to drop some bombs and then it's going to be over.
Yeah. And then you can bomb us a little bit too.
And you can bomb us. You're not going to kill anybody. He openly said it. Right. So, like, what I would like to point out, and this is Antifada shit, you know, maybe not even this wreckage shit, like, we're getting, like, the radical implication of that is that Trump is colluding with ruling classes around the world. I'm not going to say that Cuba is the same, because it's not, but colluding with other ruling classes for their respective domestic audiences, basically doing these spectacular acts of violence that benefit both the ruling classes of both of these different countries, the ruling class in general, let's say, for their domestic audiences. It's something we should be aware of, right? Lest we go too far down this geopolitical road, because ultimately at the end of the day, these ruling classes have a lot more in common with each other than we do with them. That's all I'll say.
I'm going to cheerfully disagree.
Please do.
With that. I do not view the dynamic between the American ruling class and the Iranian government, or ruling class, if you will, to be one of a wink and a handshake, so that there's some sort of kayfabe in which you hit us and we hit you. I mean, I think the Iranian government telegraphed its retaliations for both Israel and America during those two previous strikes as just a last resort. They had to retain some kind of legitimacy as a government that was defending its borders and its sovereignty. I don't think that they would have ever preferred to have you know, had those exchanges whatsoever.
I agree with that.
And I don't think the government right now, from what I understand, the Iranian government is sort of trying to figure out whether or not it can entertain a limited military conflict that calls Trump's bluff, essentially, and lets him know you can't just keep poking us forever and ever without expecting some American troops in the region to die. I just don't view them as two of the same kind putting on a show for their domestic audiences. I think it truly is an example of a hegemon forcing a regional power that is still far weaker into defending itself, even if it's slightly hollow and limited in its response. Whatever you think of the internal affairs of Iran.
Well, let's try to talk about this in terms of how it's playing out in Cuba now, because since the death of Castro, at least, there's been a bit of a thaw between the United States and Cuba, or a limited liberalization in Cuba. Definitely attempts by Díaz-Canel, the president that succeeded Castro, to open up to the United States, to slowly end the blockade and normalize relations. And when I went there in 2019, you know, the first thing that a lot of normal Cubans said to me when they met me and saw as an American is that we love Obama. Because Obama, towards the end of his second term, did open up to several countries, including Cuba, which was a really positive thing that unfortunately Biden did not do. And so as a result of Biden not reversing that, the situation is this dire. Maybe it would have gotten there anyway. But regardless, Trump now claims he's talking to the Cuban government. They deny this. They say that's not going on. They've started a new kind of military preparedness mobilization in case of an invasion. Possibly they're unloading new air defenses from Russia. But, you know, I think no matter what they're doing, if the United States wants to do what it did in Venezuela to Cuba, they probably can. What do you think would be the ideal scenario for the Cuban government here? You know, now that the United States has shown that they're willing to leave like the Chavismo regime in power in Venezuela, as long as they can do business together, is that something, do you think, that would be preferable to the Cuban Communist Party?
I believe that the American intentions with Cuba are vastly different than Venezuela. Simply like the particular antagonism that they have for the Cuban Communist Party and communist leadership in Cuba, the particular animosity that Marco Rubio, a Cuban American himself, has for Cuba. It does not seem to me that what they sought to achieve with the Maduro kidnapping and the bending of the knee that they have forced from Venezuela in the weeks since is necessarily, you know, resembles what they want from Cuba. I think the choking off that they're, you know, doing to Cuba suggests that they want to induce, and Brennan and I have brought up this reference before, but our friend Vincent Bevins, the journalist, has talked about is like trying to induce like a regime collapse. And I think in the, you know, the Cuban government, like they would love, like they're 90 miles off the coast of the United States for 60 years. Castro, like they have sought to make peace with the United States while preserving the sovereignty of their system and the integrity of their system. And I think that those terms are still more or less from the conversations we had there. Brandon, feel free to disagree. Like the conversations we had, they're like, that's still their position. They care about their sovereignty. That's like the last thing that they want to give up. And moreover, the, you know, there is the possibility, there are a bunch of different ideas that are floated for what a deal could look like. You know, I mean, the president of the United States is Donald fucking Trump. Like, is there something that you could Donnie do deals. That would like, is there something you could do for Donnie Deals where like he gets to put Trump on the name of some gaudy resort in like a part of Cuba? Is there like, it's, you know, these are, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's morally reprehensible, but like these are, and I'm not saying that I'm far from saying that these are the actual terms that a Cuban government may or may not be discussing with the White House at the moment. But it does seem that like, okay, well, if there is going to be a deal, like what are the possible terms that it could reach while also preserving Cuban sovereignty? And that's something I'm a little bit skeptical of. Like, I do think that the Trump administration now having demonstrated a bit of appetite for something like kinetic action on top of this like hyper intensified economic coercion. I mean, you know, they may feel that they can go for all the marbles, and Trump is just bragging like, oh, we're talking to the Cubans. You know, they say they're not talking. We're talking. Like, it's easy for me to see that all of this bluster is the preamble to something, you know, much more horrific.
I don't want to speculate as to what a good deal, because this is a discussion right now, is what would the Cuban deal look like? Mm. What, you know, what could they get out of him? What could they make him think he's conceded? Or rather, what could he make them think they've conceded? What might they actually concede? We've seen Sheinbaum be fairly canny about this kind of thing in the past year or so dealing with him. But I would say that anything that could ease the strangulation of the Cuban economy, which is directly related, of course, to Cuba's sovereignty. It's not like these are two separate issues, either economic relief or you retain your sovereignty. Pick a battle. They're the same battle. There is, of course, the overreach you could theoretically, you know, arrive at where you concede so much that you're giving up too much sovereignty. That may be very well have been the case in Venezuela with that latest reversal of the you know, Chavez era oil legislation. But I think that, you know, this government in Cuba is aware of how delicate a matter this is right now. Probably, unfortunately, the White House's actions in Venezuela did communicate something to them about how scared they should really be, or how seriously at least they should take this. And if it results in a deal that, you know, takes Cuba off the hit list, I don't, again, no, but Noah said, you know, hotels or some kind of exclusive rights for Americans to do some business here or in that sector. Is that a world historical victory? No. But provided that Trump or Mecca Trump doesn't rule over America for the next lifetime of all of ours, Emperor then Baron, it could be a tactical retreat. And, you know, occasionally, you know, we get people talking to us and it's always very nice, but occasionally, you know, people have said to me, you know, but what if this isn't so much the case now, but people have even said, but what if the U.S. does lift the blockade? And then there's too much American, you know, presence in the Cuban economy and they start to roll back socialism. And it's like, we are so far from that being the problem in Cuba right now. It's like beyond the comprehension of man, you know, like that is not too much. Normalization of relations is not the issue between America and Cuba right now. That is not the danger. The danger is that everyone thinks they're going to invade like tomorrow. Mm. People there we spoke to were ready for that to be the case. And so I think the academic and theoretical and book club, you know, premises about, you know, how much can they normalize with the Americans and retain their sovereignty. They're going to retain their sovereignty short of any kind of invasion that topples the government. I would just hope that they preserve as much control over the situation and please Trump personally in the way that seems to have gotten Mexico out of the hot seat a couple times up until now.
Certainly got New York City out of the hot seat when our mayor Zoran, the socialist, went to the White House and made nice with Trump. Maybe the
Kim Jong-un as well.
Yeah, did you? Rocket Man himself.
We've seen it before.
Yeah, you can charm him.
What was like the government representation like at this conference? Was Petro or his people there?
His people were there, yeah.
His people were there, and I think certain delegates got to go meet with him, like
the bolder face names there. Like Zara Sultana was present, a member of parliament from the UK. Bill de Blasio, he also came.
Poxitani Bill,
he's back to his Sandinista days.
Yeah. So you
I
know,
hope
there
they
were,
didn't let him touch the ground.
there were a bunch.
It was funny though. It was funny when so he gave his statement because it was basically, you know, maybe it's my age. I'm sorry, I sound so cynical about all this, but everyone went around and they said their statement, and his statement was just basically like, please don't be mad at us. You know, like there's going to be an election soon, and. You know, I guess that's
very
all
optimistic.
Yeah,
he was really optimistic. It was like in the rest of the room was like a lot of us, you know, sort of raised our eyebrows, like, huh?
Well, he's living his best life, you know.
He's divorced.
He's got that morning after glow.
He looked good.
He looked good.
He did look good.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to make some joke about fucking Bill de Blasio. I don't know. You know, let's not make a joke. Let me actually make a substantive point, which maybe nods back to our friendly disagreement, which Brandon and I may have had. I'm not even sure we disagree that much, which is like there's purportedly a difference between the mullahs of Iran and the Bolivarian leadership, let's say, of Venezuela, or the post-Castro leadership of Cuba, which is that Iran doesn't claim to socialism, doesn't claim to have a sort of like alternate political economy, which is potentially a universal one, which Cuba has, and Venezuela also with the Bolivarian Revolution did claim to socialism, right? So that's maybe a difference in these things. And I wonder, like, Bill de Blasio famously cut his teeth in Cuba defense back in the 1980s and Sandinista stuff in the 1980s. These have been rallying cries for the left for so long in the United States, trying to defend these particular nations. So I wonder where you guys think that connection lies nowadays, like the working class of the United States, the left in the United States, and its relationship to these regimes, what relationship it might have and what relationship it currently has.
Oh, man.
Big question. Yeah.
Well,
I know,
Brandon and I, this is one where I think Brandon and I are in pretty big agreement, because and he can intervene and tell me I'm a fucking idiot if he thinks I'm wrong with this, but like the idea of like a left in America at present that is like internationally engaged, like, I just don't buy it, man. Like,
do you think it's a good idea or not?
I think, I mean, it would be a great idea if it could be summoned. It would be nice, but it's like, there's,
I'm against it personally.
Yeah. You're like, my truck is not with the ruling class of the United States. It's with the population.
I think in the way I would sort of just simply put it is that I think the main challenge, and this extends to the left as well, are people who identify with left-wing values in America. Like, there's an enormous amount of ignorance, and I don't mean like ignorance in that like, oh, everybody's stupid. I mean like ignorance in that people do not know, by and large, about the details of what happens in life of countries outside the United States.
Like, I hate to interrupt you, bro, but people think the snow is fake. I think people might actually be stupid. I got people online who are like taking a fucking a blowtorch to the snow and being like, it doesn't melt. It's like Bilderberg Rothschild fake snow.
The sun is on it. It's not melting.
Yeah. What the fuck?
So to me, like the main, like, to the extent that there's like an ask or a next thing, it's like, well, you've got to, like, for there to be relationships between like an American left and the outside world, one, there's got to be an American left, and two, there's also got to be like people have got to know things, and they've got to be educated in the most minimal way, which is just so far from where we are right now. I feel
my thing, I had to say this when we went on Hassan, and I think I stole my policy. I don't like to do commentary on unless it's some just no brainer. Like, I don't like to do too much commentary on like domestic American groups and how they're doing and what choices they should make, and, you know, tell them what I think is blah, 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 you know, the right line on whatever, because frankly, I'm not involved in them, and I don't think my opinion is worth too much about them. So I won't say anything too specific, I guess, about what X group or DSA this or that should be doing and what they have or haven't done. I did once moderate a panel, I think, for DSA. Someone asked me to do it about Cuba, but I was the moderator. I was neutral.
Uh-huh.
As
you are on Blowback Pod.
As I am
fully neutral.
But I do think that you know, it's not terribly controversial to say that there is a long way to go, I think, before there is a mass movement in America that can connect with the mass movements in these other countries. And I think that was well understood while we were in both Colombia and Cuba.
Yeah.
I think, or at least Cuba.
And I mean, I think the way then, you know, to like proceeding from that, proceeding from Brendan's astute and correct premise, I think also what that says is, well, then look to how these governments in these other countries, how do they work to influence America? Who are they building bridges with? And it's like, yeah, they are building bridges with, you know, an American left or a self-identified American left and people who espouse those positions. But really, they are looking to build connections and to build relationships with the people who actually influence policy in America, people who hold positions of power. Whether it's, you know, mayors of large cities or it's people in Congress and so forth. And, like, I think that, again, while there are plenty of debates about, like, electoralism and just, like, you know, like, their intra-left, like America conversations about all that kind of stuff, it seems really evident that when you talk to people from other countries, you know, even people who are part of other countries' communist parties, for example, what they're interested in and what they understand as, like, being important about dealing with the U.S. is that, you know, we've got to deal with the people who have power there and who might, you know, be willing to, like, change a policy or pursue something different. And that's not to say that they're compromising or that they're, you know, that they're, like, suddenly going soft on something. But it's about a real recognition of, like, well, who actually does have power in the U.S., who could be a friend of ours and who could actually fucking wield it for some
positive end. They are looking for any friend they've got. I mean, and I wasn't trying to sound cranky before about, you know, the dorm room debates about, you know, capitulation and, you know, making coexistence happen with the great Satan instead of fighting it. I mean, that's, to me, that's all fine. If you're 18, that's great. But this is a real country with real people in it. And we, and I'll, both times I was there, they want anyone they can get in the United States to try to talk some sense and reason into people's ears who control some of this stuff and who, you know, dish out what Cuba, we can limit it to Cuba for now, what Cuba is getting from the U.S. And if Zohran Mamdani were to say some nice things about Cuba and have some kind of Cuba, New York, Havana, New York, some kind
of, that'd be kind of lit. Yeah.
You know, some, whatever connection he has as capacity of mayor, I'm not saying he controls the policy of Cuba whatsoever. They would love that. They would love it if Sanders said, you know, had some new campaign or bill about opposing aggression on Cuba. I don't think much of some of these politicians, but they would love it if AOC, you know, had some renewed thing. I said, don't hold your breath, but they would love it if they could get friends from anyone in the U.S. who had the ability to stop this tide. So it's not, they're really not picky at the moment.
All right. Want to plug Blowback? I mean, everyone listens to Blowback.
Sure. Yeah, well, for those listening who do not listen to Blowback, our current season about the history of Angola, which is also in part the story of Cuba,
right,
is currently airing our 8th episode. There are 2 more episodes coming out over the next 2 weeks. This season is one of our favorites. It really is. It's kind of got everything. It's focused in the 70s and 80s, but touches on truly like a chapter of American history and American covert operations, as well as a chapter of African history that is like pretty little known here. And so,
and Portuguese and Cuban history.
This is true. Mm-hmm. It is a special corner of history, and I'm really glad that we got to make such a like a in-depth treatment of it.
And coming up this year, if people do not know yet, we will have a regularly scheduled full length Blowback season. Sorry, I have a cold, by the way. It's why all my answers were so shitty. We have a regularly scheduled full season coming later this year, which we will announce the subject of probably shortly. But we also have a mini series, which we've announced, and we hope this will be an annual sort of auxiliary Blowback podcast each year, coming in, let's say, late April, early May. We haven't quite pegged down the release date yet, but around then, called No Daylight.
Nice.
Which will be a 3-episode miniseries about the low points, the points of tension, the points of conflict between the supposedly, you know, sunny and permanently happy relationship between the United States and the state of Israel.
Ah.
So look out for that, because it's our first time doing a kind of shorter form Blowback.
Excellent.
Excellent. Thanks, guys. Hasta la victoria siempre.
Oh, cubano, entre amarguras y escombros, Fidel Castro allá en la sierra. Mira, pueblo, entre amarguras y escombros, Fidel Castro allá en la sierra, para defender mi tierra, llevaba a Cuba en los hombros. Pueblo mío, entre luchas, entre asombros, proseguían su camino. Mira, patria, pidiéndole al Dios divino, cachita, poder triunfar para poderte rezar allá en el pico turquino.
La regaño, tita.
Picadito. Ahí. Qué lindos son los campos de mi Cuba libre, tío.
¡Viva Cuba libre, tita!
¡Que viva, tito, que viva!
¡Ataca, tita, sigue!
Patria hermosa, Camilo Cienfuegos tiene junto a sus hombres la gloria. Mira Cuba, Camilo Cienfuegos tiene junto a sus hombres la gloria de la más limpia victoria que un hombre digno sostiene. Mira Cuba, sobre sus hombros mantiene un ideal limpio y sano. Cuba santa, y yo pido al soberano gloria para el que cayó y allá en la sierra peleó por nuestro suelo cubano.
Así mismo, tía, que viva Cuba libre, tita.
Y que viva Fidel Castro, tío.
Así mismo, tita, y la linda revolución que dio la segunda independencia de Cuba, tía.
Coge por la guardarraya, tío.